This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Front Row, The Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. Being the first Friday of the month, we are talking music through time. So far, we have traveled from medieval to Renaissance to Baroque. This week, it is classical music of the 18th century. In the studio are Kevin Field, the Director of Academic and Artistic Development at Bentley Music Academy, and Dr. Andrew Filmer, Music Lecturer from Sunway University. Welcome.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. I think we've got a very, very difficult task ahead of us simply because it's so huge. But what I found interesting was when we were talking about the medieval, that spread over 900 years.
Now
we're down to like less than 100.
Yeah. It's an hour and a half. Yeah. 1722. Yeah.
I guess the first question to ask is, beyond the musicians, who were some key figures during this historical period?
I wouldn't talk about figures, but two big things were happening during this time. One was the Enlightenment, and the second was the Industrial Revolution. So those are the two big things that are happening in world history that indirectly, or you could even say directly, affected the way that music was progressing.
When you said the Enlightenment, who was getting enlightened?
Oh, hopefully everyone, I guess. But it was more about the idea that the individual had value. It wasn't just these massive institutions, whether it was certain more authoritarian governments or certain major religious institutions that determined your fate. It was the idea that the individual could have some value.
It was also during this period that we had the, in history, was the American Revolution. United States, before it was formed, 1776. I mean, it was the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, the Declaration of Independence. But we tend to put the end of the Enlightenment at the French Revolution. So once we get to the French Revolution, when, you know, we start chopping heads, basically, then we move into the Romantic period. Because it's a very passionate thing to use a guillotine.
No. So the period we're talking about starts from about 1730 to about 1820.
Yeah, right. Yes, but those things are not. We found this with the other periods. There's nothing. There's no mark in the sand that says we finished here. We finished being Baroque. Let's all suddenly become classical composers. Yeah. We were discussing this just before that everybody at that time is a contemporary composer, is a modern composer.
And the reason why I stated the period is because 1776 would fall right within that.
Yes. Yeah? But far away. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Because
geographically.
Geographically.
Does
that mean
European
in terms of the ideas, what's happening in America was quite different from what's happening in Europe?
No, I mean, I think what was happening in America was still coming in from some of these French ideas. I made fun of the guillotine, but the ideas of liberty, fraternity, and, you know, egalitarianism, certainly that was information, just like we don't have, as Kevin was saying, a clear line exactly where the classical period started. I don't think we have a clear line when people started considering themselves a little bit more enlightened. They didn't say, you know, wake up with literally a light bulb moment because, you know, light bulbs weren't invented yet.
What caused this change in attitude?
I'm very curious to know whether the Industrial Revolution itself caused a change of thinking. Because what was happening is that previous to this, most of us would be farmers, right?
We
would
be agrarian culture.
Yeah.
Yeah, now we can travel. We've got trains.
Yeah, now we can travel. Now we can go to the cities are developing because that's where factories are, right? And so when cities develop and you move, you have mobility, you got to remember if you're a farmer, you probably don't own the land that you're farming on.
That would belong to the lord of the manor.
Correct. And so you work the land, you pay off what you need to, but you didn't have a lot of freedom to choose your fate. But here you can travel, go to the city, decide to work in this factory. What was happening is that the middle class started developing. And if you're a member of the middle class, then hey, you know.
You can promote music, you can sponsor music, you can become a patron. So we're moving away from church and court in that sense. What's fascinating, certainly with Baroque classical, is the fact that in spite of not pre-steam engine in that sense and being able to travel, that these ideas, these so-called classical ideas or Baroque ideas, were germinating in various places at the one time around Europe. That's quite extraordinary. And they would have been growing without, I mean, yes, there was influence of travel, you know, and communication in that sense. But someone's idea in Florence or Vienna would be shared at the same time in Munich or Berlin in that sense. That's quite extraordinary.
It was just in the air.
Maybe, but it's interesting, I feel, that these huge institutions didn't do more to consolidate their power. Because you could see progress is good, and these, you know, I don't think they saw what it would do to the sort of heavy hegemony that they had over the people, and good thing that they didn't, really.
Because music was now, like you say, sponsored by the middle class, what happened to music?
There were concerts. We were getting into the concert realm. We were evolving. We had orchestras now fully defined in something that we would recognize now with a full string section, double winds, two oboes, two bassoons, two flutes, and eventually a couple of clarinets, some horns, timpani, and a couple of trumpets. So that's something that we would recognize that was defined and set, and that's the Mannheim influence.
The piano come into play too?
It was the forte piano at that time, which is a fascinating instrument.
Not quite the piano we have today.
No, we have the piano forte today, and they had the forte piano. So just like how we say a Mercedes instead of Mercedes-Benz, we now just call
Speak
it a...
Speak for yourself.
No, I know. Yeah, but we now just call it a piano today, but actually it's instrument that can play softly and loudly, right? That's what it is. I'd like to add to what Kevin was saying. It's not just that the orchestra was forming, but a flute had a very specific purpose, and you're not just going to replace it with anybody else. That's the reason why you have these numbers.
Idiomatic writing.
Yes, that's right. And which comes back to the power of the individual, right? The whole philosophy that everybody has a specific role, and let's not just simply interchange one person for the other. Everybody has a special role.
And yet some would describe the music of this period as being somehow less complex than the Baroque. What does that mean when you have individuals as opposed to just thinking of a group of people playing the same music? Suddenly you have different instrumentation. Mm-hmm. That would suggest complexity rather than simplicity.
To some degree, with the classical period, there was a wiping the slate clean and going back to the basics. So our line... a melodic line, and then accompanied this way. Mm-hmm. Of course, there was Baroque music was still being written into the classical period. There's still that complexity. But, I mean, the Bachs really pushed, the whole family pushed harmonically that complexity and thematically in that sense. So what we've got now is rather than one extended idea being stretched throughout a whole movement, if you like, this being crunched into 4 8-bars, 12-bar phrase, which is then opposed or answered. And it's becoming, to use a word we're going to use in a couple of programs for now, almost a minimalist approach to what had gone before, cleaning up the ideas. One line, harmonic accompaniment.
And you've got to understand where the word classical comes from as well. So
this period.
Yeah, so classical means looking back to
looking
the classics.
Back, yes.
And they looked back to the Romans and the Greeks and the idea of balance and the idea of contrast and balance, whereas, you know, the word Baroque itself is an insult. It literally means an irregularly shaped pearl, which means that you people have been decorating yourselves to such an extent that you don't realize that what would have been beautiful by itself, a pearl, is now so irregularly bent out of shape, and so you don't quite appreciate the value of simplicity. Look at a pearl. It's beautiful by itself.
By itself.
Yeah. Mm. And that's the whole concept of what classical music was trying to create.
Does this suggest a rejection of Baroque music?
In some ways, they wanted something new because, you see, Baroque music is very intellectual. To understand a fugue, to appreciate a fugue, you really need to know what's going on and appreciate the majesty of how it all intertwines and how that fourth voice comes in and, oh my goodness, and now we've reached this key. That's a genius of musical engineering, but it really takes a lot of prerequisite knowledge. Now you're having the middle class come in, you're having more public concerts, you need a more public music as well. So you needed to make things simpler in order for it to fit a lower common denominator, in a sense. I'm not saying that classical music was necessarily dumbed down, but it was certainly... But
you could tell that was my comment.
Well, yeah.
But that's why we have, so many tunes that people can remember they're going to be Mozart more than anything from that period. They're not going to be necessarily Beethoven, although everybody will reckon, you know, etc. It's not going to be a Haydn tune that someone's going to be whistling. It's going to be a Mozart. I mean, look at that. I mean, even Mozart appeared on one of the first Nokia phones as a ringtone. So it stands the test of time. Yeah.
You've already introduced one name. Who are the key composers, key musicians from this period?
Haydn, Stamitz, Beethoven, through to Schubert. And then right at the very end, sort of a little bit of Chopin, a little bit of Schumann, but that's stretching the point a little bit. But basically, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven.
I guess when you have just said that there's no line in the sand that says, here we are in Baroque, now we're in classical, or classical going to romantic music, Beethoven, in a way, straddles both?
Beethoven sort of introduced the next era, really.
He's not quite in the next
year. You know, if you want somebody who moved from the Baroque into the classical, you look at some of Bach's children, people like C.P.E. Bach, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, and it gets very interesting to look at how that worked, because not only were they creating music that sort of – they grew up in J.S. Bach's household, but they are moving to a simpler time. But they also chronicled, I think C.P. Bach chronicled the first biography, or he influenced the first biography of Bach, of J.S.'s father, J.S. Bach. But all sorts of things, the development of instruments were happening at this time. So you have this wonderful double concerto for harpsichord and fortepiano. So you have some of that in between, and Beethoven sort of towards the end, but you're moving as far as Chopin.
Well, yeah, no, that's just my little... I want to stretch, because I'm thinking about how much time we don't have to talk about the Romantic period. So I'm bringing some of those guys forward. But no, Haydn's regarded as the grandfather of the symphony in that sense. I mean,
And the string quartet.
And the string quartet, yes. Yeah. That's the template. I mean, he refines that in terms of form. And that stretch, we talked about the dance suite, the overture, and those four movements in the Baroque period, forming the foundation for the symphony. So if you're almost, to some extent, you're taking the overture from that dance suite, which we're not meant to be dance to, but you're taking that overture, you're taking the overture from the dance suite and putting that in the very introduction of that first movement, which is, this is very important for us, that first movement of certainly of a symphony being in a certain form, which is called sonata form or first movement form or sonata allegro form. That's absolutely crucial, and that's in terms of architecture and foundation moving forward is absolutely crucial.
Perhaps this provides us with a good segue into talking about what is the sonata form, something that you musicians know about, and those of us who know about anything about it, we have to read up without understanding or what it is we are listening to. I'm speaking with Kevin Field and Andrew Filmer, and we are discussing classical music, that is, European art music from the period between 1730 and 1820, although we today tend to use the word classical music in a very loose way to refer to anything that is not contemporary. The classical period is the one which follows the Baroque period and sitting in between that and the Romantic period. Coming up, more about the evolution of music, and we'll talk about the sonata form. This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Tune to Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng with two musicians and music educators, Kevin Field of Bentley Music Malaysia and Andrew Filmer of Sunway University. This afternoon, we are talking about European music from 1730 to 1820, a 90-year period, and the music from this time is called classical music. We were talking about the sonata form. What is it?
I don't think I would consider it just European, though. I think the term that we use is Western art music. And I'm reminded of this because you were talking about 1776, earlier Declaration of Independence. Benjamin Franklin was a composer, too. So quite interestingly...
Really? We know of him as an inventor, but I have not... and also as a writer.
Yeah, we know that he wrote at least two string quartets. One of them was based only on open strings. So he got the four instruments to tune to all sorts of different strings, and you could play the entire piece with just open strings. And the idea of this was that you could get your friends together, and if they didn't have any skill in playing the instrument, just say, when you see this, play this open string, right? You should at least be able to play an open string.
And everybody comes, can bow?
Well, hopefully, you know, at least there's that. But the whole idea, again, is egalitarianism, power to the individual. Everyone has accessibility to play music. So not just European music, I would say. Sorry, I've gone in a different direction.
But to the sonata form.
Yeah. A beginning, middle, and an end. In simple sense, like writing an essay, you've got to have something at the beginning and develop that idea and then come back to your original argument. So you have three forms, so three main sections: the exposition, the original idea, the development itself, and then the recapitulation, which returns to the exposition, those first ideas. And basically the middle section is a development on the first couple of ideas presented to you in the home key, in the tonic key. So let's say we're in C major. We will rattle around in C major and end up at the end of that section in the dominant, so in G, go into the development section itself, and then tend to go round, just go round like a washing machine and cycle of fifths. For argument's sake, we'll just develop this idea, we'll go to this key, we'll go to that key, we'll go to that key, and then eventually come back out through the wash and with the final statement, and then eventually finishing with the home key.
And it's so clean once it comes out of the wash that it stays in the home key now. It doesn't need to go anywhere else.
When you talk about introduces an idea, one can understand that in terms of words. Here's my thesis, and you have your sentence, I will argue this. And then within the development, you argue your thesis. How is that done in music? How do you develop a line to the point that you develop a line, but I can still hear it, but it's not the same? So there is repetition, but at the same time, differentiation.
Yes. So coming back to those values, the two values are balance and contrast. So you get repetition, which provides you a sense of balance, but you have this differentiation, which gives you that sense of contrast. It's not only in sonata form. You have minuet and trio, which is the same idea. You have minuet and it goes to the trio, which is something different. It goes back to the minuet again. So a lot of times in this classical period, you just have this idea of balance and contrast. But speaking about sonata form, how the development is created, I mean, that's the magic question, right? Whether a piece that's written in sonata form appeals to your ear is whether that development in some ways was, how tuneful the exposition was. But for me anyway, how cleverly done this development was. And sometimes people like Mozart in particular, he takes themes from the first section that you wouldn't have expected him to develop. And so that was one of his tricks. It's, you think I'm going to develop this main idea, but you know that little bit at the end which you thought was not consequential, I'll make that into this whole new idea and development, and ta-da! It's sort of like giving you a dessert in advance in the beginning, and not you don't realize it's a dessert, but it's, oh, let's this appetizer of apple something. And you think, oh, this is lovely, and it's lovely that you added some raisins on the top. And you found that the whole development is just based on raisins instead of being based on an apple, something like that.
So when the main course comes, you see more apples.
You think it's apples and more apples, but it turns out it's apples and more raisins. Apples again at the end. Yeah.
Talking about this sonata form, what new ideas were introduced during this classical period? We have talked about the cleaning up from the Baroque, going to something simpler or something clearer and cleaner. Mm. And then we've talked about the sonata form. What are the elements to music?
Using nature as a metaphor for human emotion, I think that's something we're getting to as well. But you've got the foundation, you've got that classical foundation of form, and we're going towards Mendelssohn at the end of a period whereby, and also Beethoven, looking at using tone painting pictures with music and using arguments to justify our relevance, you know, in society, in the world, in that sense. So you've got a certain amount of tone painting coming through with some of this work.
I need for you to help me understand this term about
tone painting.
Toned painting.
Yeah. Painting pictures with sound. So programmatic music to some extent. So I think one of the extracts that I've given you is the Hebrides Overture of Mendelssohn. And that wonderfully describes, obviously, through sounds, you know, the dark, brooding sea around the Hebrides itself and the Rocky Mass and all of that and ocean going. So there's a certain element of that's using those sounds as a metaphor. We have the altruistic, almost existential element of symphonic writing itself and developing a simple theme. A simple theme in inverted commas. There's nothing simple in it, all the way through to fairly complex ideas about nature.
Yeah, if you listen to early Mendelssohn when he was a teenager, we always talk about the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. Well, he wrote two, actually. When we say the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, we mean the one he wrote later in life. Mm-hmm. But he wrote one when he was, I think, a teenager, and it sounds like it would have been a contemporary of Mozart, almost. You know, it's really quite interesting. Then he moves all the way, as Kevin was saying, to the Hebrides Overture, which is when you close your eyes, you just see these waves being formed by the orchestra. What's interesting, if you really go into it, he sketched two things out when he went to Scotland. He sketched out the idea of the waves. I think it was a sketch, piano sketch, about these waves that are dee da da dee dee da. But he also actually sketched out what he was seeing in terms of the image that he was trying to portray, literally. Because the Hebrides, the Fingal's Cave of the Hebrides, is actually a six-sided natural geographic formation. So it's a strange cave that actually, it looks like somebody actually carved it out with a ruler. But he was so fascinated with being there with all these waves that he actually took a pencil out and drew the cave and the waves itself. So you can tell, if you wanted any real proof of it, as if you needed any from the music itself. But those were the images he was trying to convey.
So what you're telling me is that he composed the music in such a way that we could see in our mind's eye what he saw.
I think the music itself is
evocative.
Yeah,
yes.
It brings in that the image of what you're trying to portray.
And Beethoven in Pastoral Symphony as well. I mean, similar things apply there. There's a storm coming, and it's very clear what that storm is all about. You know, and there's a sunrise after the storm, and there's a bird floating away and singing in the sky. You know, so.
And speaking of sunrise, I think another one is that of a Haydn symphony that talks about.
Oh gosh, that's extraordinary.
Daybreak.
Absolutely amazing. Mm. Absolutely amazing music. Really is incredible. And what's also fascinating when Andrew was talking about age is a lot of these gentle, and they are gentlemen, they were writing so young, at such a young age.
Yep.
You know, barely, you know, into two figures, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, writing this music. Absolutely extraordinary.
What gave them the idea to create music that would capture these or be evocative? I mean, you would think that music is always about trying to evoke something.
I generally try to think of the Baroque. It's really an oversimplification. I'll use that caveat right in front. But if you look at about Baroque music, then classical, then Romantic, I look at it as the time to think, that's the Baroque, then the time to feel, which is coming up in the classical period. And time to feel some more, which is the Romantic period that comes over there. But within this clarity, I mean, you start realizing that, I mean, when you're only building a melody with quite a relatively simplified accompaniment, well, then you got to do something about what appeals about that melody. I mean, this is not coming from music history. This is why I think, based on listening to music of this period, you're dealing with just a nice melody. Now that you're going to find out that melody can convey a whole lot of information. And since you're thinking about the individual, you're thinking about one of the words that's used for music of this period is sentimentality, the idea of bringing sentiment out. That all comes into place when you have this focus on a melody compared to a focus on polyphony where all of the jigsaw puzzle has to all fit together.
Properly.
You don't have to worry so much about that. And you can let the melody carry an idea through.
And you focus on the melody as well. We were talking earlier about if you're going to remember a tune from the classical period, more often than not, it's going to be Mozart than anything. You could think about some of the opera elements in that sense. But you know, Eine kleine Nachtmusik and the various symphonies. There are so many melodies. So I ask myself, why is that? Why specifically Mozart? Why was he able to keep writing all these successful tunes, almost hit after hit after hit? And is it something to do with the way that he was, his working environment? Was he one of the first to turn towards being an independent musician in that sense? So that he had to write. He had to write a tune that was going to be memorable, that people wanted to listen to again.
Be a pop star of his time.
Yeah.
I would say the first real pop star was Franz Liszt, you know, probably, and then Paganini around that time. So I think we really had icons in the Romantic period. But in this period, you did have a bit of a focus on the composer. And the composer would very often be the performer as well. So, yeah, you did have some of that. Mozart did have a name for himself. And people would come not just to listen to the music, but to...
to watch him perform.
To watch him, yeah. You got to understand, he was this prodigy. He was brought around the whole of Europe. His father was a bit of a strange character. He tried to lie about his son's age until he could not deny that his son was no longer a child.
He was trying to get a free meal.
That's right, yeah. But yeah, there was a focus on the individual at this point. But I'm not sure whether I've helped answer the question about what makes Mozart's melodies just so memorable. Some magic in there that don't know all the answers, but he was just quite...
In a sense, placing him within the classic period doesn't really quite answer the question, why is his music so memorable?
I don't know. But he charms us today, and he'll charm us tomorrow.
What is the legacy that this period has left for us today?
Balance, order, proportion, contrast of mood, flexibility of rhythm, melody, form.
And the orchestra, of course. And the string quartet. Those are big things that I think we have certainly the formation of the orchestra.
I remember I was for some time in the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, and someone who one of the rank and file violins was leaving and retire, and he said, I've been privileged to be working in this orchestra, Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, one of the oldest provincial UK orchestra in the country. He said, I've been privileged to be part of what I believe to be one of mankind's greatest inventions, the symphony orchestra.
I think one of the things that we were talking about earlier is the creation of what we call the crescendo, right? And I think it's one of those words that in the English language has been so misused.
Gradually getting louder.
It's a process. Rising to a crescendo. Yeah. Sports commentators all the time drives me up the wall. Rising to a crescendo. No, it's already...
The whole point is that it is rising. Yeah.
Will you rattle off for us a list of music from this particular period that if we want to get ourselves acquainted with this, the music of this period, that
wow.
What should we listen to?
Well, you should find the oldest Nokia phone that you have.
Yes, start with that. Start with that.
And then you find this. Yeah.
2G minus infinity. So I've given you one of those, 25, number 25. That's why I wanted to, because that is such an electric movement, especially the first movement, the 25.
Yeah.
Andrew was singing 40, isn't it? 40. That's really hard to pinpoint someone definitely who you have to listen to. That order of Stamitz, and Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, I think if you're going through any of that, you can spend a long time in Mozart, many different characters of Mozart. He will be, even in his symphonies, there's an opera character, or then suddenly there is a cantata. With Mozart, with whatever you are listening to or performing, you've got the church, you've got the opera, you've got, you know, serious opera, comic opera, and then you've got the symphonic elements all wrapped up, whether it's a quartet or a symphony.
Yeah, I would say that finding Mozart's not difficult. You can just go online, favorite Mozart, and you'll find a playlist somewhere. But I think perhaps it's easier to mention Haydn because a person who doesn't regularly listen to classical music may not be as familiar with Haydn. And you've got, for me, with Haydn, you've got everything that has a specific name you can go and listen to. You start off with the ones that have a special name. So you have things like the Toy Symphony, the Surprise Symphony, although it may not be as surprising today.
The Farewell,
you have to try and watch a video of that because the Farewell Symphony was a protest piece, basically. It says that if you're not going to pay us properly, we're going to quit. And so one after another, these musicians would just blow off their candles because there were no lights, right? It was just candles. Blow off their candles and walk off the stage until you're left with like one person, one violinist.
And you've also be careful with, say, going into Beethoven, because if you take some of the late Beethoven string quartets or the Große Fugue, you could actually put some of that music into a concert of Schoenberg, you know, Second Viennese School, and it would fit very, very comfortably in there. I mean, really abstract, advanced writing.
Thank you, folks, for coming in.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Join us again next month when we talk about romantic music.
I'm bringing a singer.
And again, if you have questions about music, dance, theater, or art, drop us a line at biggerpicture@bfm.my. And this is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.